I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas. Voices. For some, they can be a revelation, a calling. Moses heard voices several times. The prophets Elijah and Isaiah did, too. They heard the voice of God, an authority that informs many of the books of the Old Testament. It seems voices have always been with us. Teresa of Avila, among other mystics, put her saintly enthusiasms down to taking dictation. And modern-day channelers, seers, and psychics claim to be in touch with divine sources that speak directly to them. Don Hill is the host of Tapestry on CBC Radio 1, and tonight, in the final installment of this two-part series, he investigates the muses that speak from the outside and in. Visions and Voices, Part 2, by Don Hill.
I hear voices. You heard me say that, didn't you? You heard my voice, distinctly, as if I'm talking to you, directly to you, and only you. That's what radio does well. It creates a sense of intimacy. It's like magic. I send, you receive, and we think nothing of it. Now, imagine if this was over 100 years ago. No radio. Not even a crystal set to pick up signals. Yet here I am, talking to you. What would you make of my voice then? I hear voices. When I read quietly to myself, mostly it's my own voice I hear. But a sentence in quotation marks silences the me that's talking in my head, and a stranger's voice comes to mind. I can hear that person, that character, that voice. It also happens when I write, except in reverse. An occupational hazard, I'm told. Sometimes he won't shut up, an exasperated author said of one of her fictional creations. It's as if the character takes on a life of its own. Voices, in the head, a muse, inspiration, telling me what to do. Sometimes it scares the hell out of me. Eddie Ensley hears voices, sees things too. He's Cherokee, a Native American and a deacon candidate in the Roman Catholic Church. He holds a graduate degree in theology.
At an earlier age, say the 14th century, visions were seen as widespread. We have thousands of accounts of them in ordinary people. Your name didn't have to begin with saint.
Eddie Ensley has written several books over the 40 years he studied mystical experience. His latest is called Visions, The Soul's Path to the Sacred. His first, in print since the 1970s, is Sounds of Wonder, Speaking in Tongues in the Catholic Tradition.
All of us are touched by wonder. All of us are touched by awe. And in fact, one Lutheran minister with a PhD in theology from Harvard and a sociologist, Milo Breck, he did a survey of average parishioners in Protestant and Catholic churches in Minnesota and found that 30% have had it sometime in their life, traumatic prophetic dreams, hearing the voice of God. A Wall Street Journal poll said that 40% of Americans believe that God speaks to them weekly. So we're speaking of something that's quite widespread.
The National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago also found that of the 3,000 Americans surveyed in the late 1990s, people from across the social spectrum, more than 40% believe they have been contacted by a deceased loved one, and close to 70% reported moments of extrasensory perception.
Most of us have one major experience of the mystical in our lives. About 5% are frequent experiencers. That's a lot of people. In fact, that's more people than play golf well. That's a lot more people than play the piano well. And it's not a particularly elite group of people.
Voices. They're everywhere, and nowhere in particular. I'm going to skip around a bit, go non-linear. There's a reason for this, and it will become apparent by the end of the program. In 1995, I lived in Vancouver, and the wet coast being, well, kind of out there, I was introduced to notions about divination and the spirit. I was on a quest. I was looking for answers to a mystery. I had been haunted by a sense of presence in the Rocky Mountains, and I thought the house I was living in had a ghost in it. Anne McNeil, a Tibetan Buddhist nun I know in Vancouver, recommended a psychic. Sarah's top-notch, really knows her stuff, she said. An oracle. How can you tell, I thought. It's not as if there's a Consumer Reports on the reliability of soothsayers and seers. But I was game. There was nothing to lose, although I felt kind of embarrassed for visiting. Sarah, why do most psychics only go by their first name? Sarah's place of business was in her home, a modest walk-up apartment in Kitsilano, a trendy part of Vancouver.
This ability has developed over time to the point where I can remove myself, my personality self, and emotional, mental self from the scene and allow somebody else to talk through me. Now, I'm aware that there's a debate as to whether this is my subconscious. I can't explain how it works. I just know that it does work.
What Sarah is talking about is channeling, tuning into voices, spirits who take over, speak through her. Yikes, I thought. Here I am cavorting with the New Age crowd. Well, not quite. More like the Middle Ages, medieval in this case. Sarah's principal guide is a Tibetan monk from the 6th century, a guy called Masaya.
Okay, so I'll take a little bit of time.
Sarah is going into trance now, a kind of waking dream.
Well, good afternoon to you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I kept my questions neutral, didn't load them with any information which Sarah might turn around and impress me with. Simple queries like, is anyone trying to contact me?
Well, I would put it to you, Mr. Don, that who is trying to contact you is yourself. The other realities that you exist in within the present time are wishing to connect and be manifested through this plane so that the challenges, the endeavors that you chose to incorporate within your soul's journey will be overcome or will be assisted by this process.
At the time, this advice sounded like gobbledygook. But in hindsight, Sarah's Masaya was oddly prophetic. I'll be talking to you again, Mr. Don, the guide intoned before signing off. And it kind of spooked me. Listening to this recording years later, a shock of recognition. Some predictions make sense now. But that's jumping ahead of my story.
Mediumship was the name the Victorians called this. And of course, this whole practice can be traced back to the biblical prophets. They would go into trance and write down the word of God, which has become our Bible.
This is Joe Fisher, a former journalist with the Toronto Sun. He's authored a book about mediums and channeling, The Siren Call of the Hungry Ghosts, written out of a personal experience with supernatural voices.
Now, what's the difference, I ask myself, between the biblical prophets and their cataleptic utterances being put down as the Bible and what many channelers are doing today? Not too much, I would suggest. Of course, it could also be traced back to the Greek oracles and shamanism. Shamans all over the world in different cultures would go into trance and would diagnose people who had ailments, mental and physical. And shamans are still doing that. And the Christian church will hold up talking in tongues when people are seized via trance, and then they will start uttering different languages. This is all in the same mix.
Joe Fisher. The Old Testament is riddled with voices. For instance, and the Lord said unto Moses, the idea of the Lord being a voice that can be heard, clearly audible to some people. It's a call that's heard again and again.
And My name is Gillian Gill. A few years ago, I wrote a biography of Mary Baker Eddy, the founder and discoverer of Christian Science.
I'm on the phone with Gillian Gill at her home in Massachusetts. Christian Science had its genesis in the 19th century. The Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses were also founded around the same time in the United States, all by religious prophets, and all of the prophets claimed they were instructed by voices, voices they attributed to a divine source.
When Mrs. Eddy was 8 years old, she heard a voice calling her. She was in a room by herself. Her mother was in another room. And she heard a voice calling, she says, distinctly, by name, three times in an ascending scale. And she went into her mother and said, "Mother, you called me." And her mother says, "No, I didn't. What do you mean?" So she goes out, and this happens again a number of times. Mrs. Baker said, "No, I didn't call." And she then, that evening, read to Mary the tale of the young Samuel, the story from 1 Samuel, where Samuel is lying in the temple, and he hears the voice of the Lord, and he is told by the prophet Eli to respond and say, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." And Mary's mother says to her, "Mary, when you hear the voice again, say, 'Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.'" And Mary Baker Eddy remembers that the voice came, and I was afraid, and I did not answer. Afterwards, I wept and prayed that God would forgive me, resolving to do next time as my mother had bidden me. When the call came again, I did answer in the words of Samuel. So you can hear that she is quite sure that she's hearing the voice with her ears, that it has sort of musical frequency. It's repeated, and it's her name, and it's a female voice. She thinks it is her mother. This makes it an exceptionally interesting example of someone receiving a kind of authority from God, and that the voice of God is a female voice.
Florence Nightingale heard voices. She was 16. Sitting under the giant cedars, the cedars of Lebanon, a sacred grove in Hampshire, England, she heard an unmistakable command. February the 9th, 1837, Florence Nightingale dutifully recorded in her diary, "I heard the voice of God calling me to his service."
It's clear that she felt that God was calling her. The question was, what was he asking her to do? And she went through this long period of, you know, more than 10 years of feeling that she had failed God because she had not responded to those voices. And when the Crimean War comes through and she is able to go out and actually do the kind of hands-on practical nursing work with sick and dying men, this was the realization of her divine mission, she felt. So there's a very, very clear relationship in her mind and in her actions between the cause and the way that she shaped her life.
Gillian Gill. Spirit transmissions, mesmerism, voices from afar were all the rage in the late 19th century. Thought transference was the technical term for hearing voices, and it was of particular interest to the Society for Psychical Research. Sigmund Freud, Carl Gustav Jung, the writer Sir Arthur Conan Doyle were among the elite membership of the British organization. Philosopher William James was its president in 1884 and later helped to found the ASPR, the American Society for Psychical Research, the next year. To launch the ASPR, the Society figured that telepathy was a reasonable candidate for its first investigation. Despite interesting leads, strange anomalies, and even odder characters who presented themselves for scientific research, the Society came up with nothing conclusive. And over a century later, science remains either mystified or utterly dismissive of telepathic communication. spiritualism, the belief in discarnate phantoms communicating with the here and now, has been with us for a long while. Channeling is the current enthusiasm, the sound of spirits speaking through mediums in trance. Last fall, I attended a channeling seance at the Odesso Center, a New Age parlor 2 floors off Toronto's Yonge Street. Joe Fisher, the author of a book on channeling, was invited to interview an entity conjured by a medium. I tagged along with Joe. I was curious why the former journalist would take an interest in this stuff. "I fell in love with Philippa," he began. Philippa was his channeled lover, a woman of Greek origin long dead, a spirit that deceived him, he said. A story that Joe tells best in his book about the whole incident. I wanted to know more about what he calls hungry ghosts.
The Buddhists have the word preta, which means hungry ghost. And a hungry ghost, in their tradition, is an entity that is lost between this world and the next. The Tibetan Book of the Dead warns about these entities. I might add that a hungry ghost or a preta is a being seen by the Buddhists as a being with a very scrawny, narrow neck, but capacious stomachs. These beings can never get enough. They can never be filled. They can never be satisfied. And that is why they're seizing onto channelers who do have this door open to the next world. They are speaking through them, and they are trying forever to fill themselves up with the energy and emotions of the living. They can never do this, but that's why they're called hungry ghosts. They're always hungry.
Participants at the channeling session I attended at the Odesso Center were predominantly middle class, middle-aged, female, and white. The medium, 50-ish and comfortable, channeled a farmer from the 18th century. At least that's what she led us to think. Her spirit guides spouted truisms. It all seemed silly. Low-rent psychology. Anyone might recognize it as the things one ought to have learned in kindergarten. I couldn't record the proceedings, but I was allowed a question. So I asked the entity, "Do you know when you are?" The question confused the channel. "How does the entity navigate forever?" I asked again. The medium countered my question with a question whether I believed in spirit communication. And I said it wouldn't be sensible to believe in anything, given the evidence provided that evening. This created a bit of a stir in the room. People were getting ticked off. One fellow, one of the few men, jabbed his finger in my chest and angrily declared me trouble. I thought it prudent to leave. Channeling is indeed troublesome. But beyond my experience at the Odesso Center, I still don't know what to make of these voices. Others share in my discomfort, and channeling has been set off on a siding by the scientific establishment. Still, there are exceptions. A case in point. Madame Blavatsky, the founder of Theosophy in the late 19th century, regularly communed with her Mahatma spirit guides. A collection of her channeled scribblings were collated and published in 1923 as the Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnott. Many years later, a young electrical engineering student at MIT read the book. His name was Elmer Green. Today, Dr. Elmer Green is emeritus at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas. Over his long career, he pioneered the use of biofeedback, an effective tool for managing stress. He's a highly regarded clinician. But back to the Mahatma letters. Madame Blavatsky's guide, a channeled spirit guide, described an elaborate scene in a monastery in Old Tibet, a country that was strictly off-limits to Westerners. Remember, it's the 19th century. Travel to exotic places wasn't as easy as it is today. And it would have been next to impossible for Madame Blavatsky, a middle-aged woman, to physically travel to Tibet. She just wouldn't have been allowed in. Blavatsky's spirit guide described in precise detail how energies were manifested by Buddhist monks as they meditated upon their own image reflected in a polished metal plate. The spirit guide also made a curious reference to magnets, a bar magnet, suspended over the meditator's head. Zappy effects, too, and from the sound of the description, it read like sparks of electrical energy. The young Elmer Green recognized in this elaborate description what looked to be a scientific experiment, an electrical engineering experiment he could do in a laboratory. And years later, Dr. Green assembled a replica of what Madame Blavatsky's spirit guide described. It's the 1980s, almost a century after Blavatsky's prophecy. The experiment worked. What other scientific experiments lurk in the Mahatma letters? Dean Radin is the author of The Conscious Universe.
When the theosophists first starting to use clairvoyance to study the deep structure of matter, of course, at that time, they didn't know anything about quarks or about subatomic. They just barely knew about atomic structure at the time. And so a century later, when people have looked back on what they drew, it turns out that there are very close correspondences between what the clairvoyants said that they saw, and of course there are no microscopes even today that can see that structure, but it is very close to what we think actually exists at that level. That suggests that clairvoyance in general not only is a real phenomena, of course there's a lot of other evidence for it, but that the limits of what it can see go down from the extreme microscale to probably the extreme macroscale, and we don't know where those limits are.
Madame Blavatsky was a controversial medium. Her reputation is still smeared by allegations of fraud. However, her investigators have also been accused of deception. Madame Blavatsky was very much for the scientific investigation of human perception. She was well-read, well-informed about the science of the late 19th century, and she was highly critical of Darwin's theory of evolution. Madame Blavatsky believed it didn't go far enough. It didn't account for the evolution of consciousness, the evolution of the spirit.
I think that science can certainly investigate these phenomena, and I think that in the past, scientists have been too quick to label all of this pathological and delusional.
Stan Krippner is a professor of psychology at the Saybrook Institute in San Francisco.
I would not use the word delusional because these people are operating within a certain frame of reference, and whether these spirits are products of the imagination or whether they are contacting entities or agencies from another dimension of reality is not really a topic that I'm particularly interested in. What I'm interested in is how these rituals, how these ceremonies, how the contact with these assumed and alleged spirits help make a person's life better, how they empower a person, especially, by the way, for women.
The island of Trinidad, home of Pan, steel drum music, and carnival. But I'm in a church, and this is the ritual beat and moan of the Shouters, the spiritual Baptist faith of the Caribbean.
My name is Everett Van Hannigan. I came from a spiritual background of Baptist people, which is in the Baptist faith, and we pray. And when we pray, sometimes the spirit is so strong that it's like you're summoning spirits.
Leader Everett is my host at St. Teresa's, an ordinary building in a neighborhood of modest homes, whitewashed brick, the entrance to the church open to the elements. From the street, you can see the congregation, people on their feet, stomping, and I hear an ambient murmur, a kind of muttering under the breath.
During praying and certain bits of spiritual behaviors, you would see it like somebody change. They will speak in tongues, like they will speak African, they will speak Hindi, they will speak Chinese. It depends on the spirit that is with that person at that time.
The Shouters Spiritual Baptists recently celebrated the 50th anniversary of the lifting of a ban prohibiting the practice of the religion in Trinidad and Tobago. Authorities on the Caribbean islands were fearful of the shouters, suspected they were able to hex and cast spells. The faith, in their view, was akin to voodoo, disguised by a thin veil of Christianity. Of particular concern was the ritual of speaking in tongues.
Something actually takes you over. You're awake, but as yet it is not of your will. It's like of God's will of doing what God wants you to do, saying the things that what he wants you to see. This spirit shows you things. Your eyesight becomes greater. The power of your eyesight becomes greater. What your normal eye would not see, at that time you become so powerful that you can see things around people. You will see other things around people that you know that is not there, but you are the only one to be seeing it. What you call roaming spirits, spirits that would roam, spirits walk between you, spirits are there with each and every one of us. They stand next to you, and this is something that a lot of people may not believe, but it happens.
I see this in such parts of the world as Brazil, where millions of people are members of African Brazilian religions, one of the cornerstones of which is spirit possession, where people have been trained, and this is not only the mediums, this is the common, ordinary people who have been trained to allow the spirits to come in and possess them.
Lord God Almighty.
Now, here we have many large and socially significant religions in which the replacement of one's personal identity is a part of the religious service. And this is a technology of the sacred.
My name is Reverend Viola Winifred Antoine. I'm the mother and the founder of our spiritual Baptist church, St. Eusebius Spiritual Baptist Church.
Why are dreams so important to spiritual Baptists?
The Word of God says, where there is no dreams and vision, the people perish. It was through a dream God tell Joseph, take his wife Mary and come from Egypt because Pharaoh is looking to kill Jesus. And many other things we have is only come through dreams. But you have to be very careful with dreams, because if you are not grounded in the Word of God, you might get dreams which isn't pertaining to God, and sometimes it look alike.
Tanti Viola speaks for several wisdom traditions that use dreams as a guide to daily living. But it's only a guide, she cautions, and thinking otherwise can get you into trouble. Doubly so if you have a professional reputation at stake. It's an area of scientific inquiry where even angels fear to tread.
This is Ideas on CBC Radio 1, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Tonight, the second part of a two-part series, Visions and Voices. The program is written and presented by the host of Tapestry, Dawn Hill.
I'm in the neuroscience laboratory of Michael Persinger at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario. This is where the new maps of consciousness are being drawn. The young scientists here are neurocartographers. Write that expression down, because you're going to be hearing it in the next few years. Dr. Persinger investigates claims for the paranormal. They're clues to the riddle of consciousness, he says.
So this is Mr. Harabans?
Well, let me go to someone else.
This is Sean Harabans, the renowned psychic from Trinidad. He's giving a demonstration of his clairvoyant abilities in the lab. I'm with a group of people circled around the psychic.
Gosh, this Buddhist priest with a stick behind you.
Mm-hmm. A Buddhist priest?
Mm-hmm. With a big stuff behind you. He's shaved. No hair in his head. He don't want you to drive.
This session was recorded in the summer of 2000. Earlier that spring, Dr. Persinger invited me to join the lab as an associate researcher, and I've been participating in several ongoing experiments. This is one of them. Listening now, I can't help think this might be Messiah doing the talking. You'll recall Sarah's spirit guide earlier in the program.
You like to listen to songs, music. But he worried about you. Why are you worried about him, Phil?
Sean Haribance claims he's in touch with angels. They speak to him. And he's looking over my shoulder now, his eyes skyward. It's kind of weird.
He said you were married once, it didn't work out, and you're married and you had to work on it. So you worried about that. There's a woman in California that go grab you away from your wife, so be careful. And when you like a woman, you leap and then you look.
I giggle nervously. The details aren't dead accurate, but this is getting too close. You see, I know of a woman from the West Coast, and let's just say she likes me a lot. Nothing has happened, okay?
Anyone in California? California could be Cali, I don't know. But I get a vision of her. She's attractive, she's bright. I mean, is she a friend or something?
Sean Haribance is in his early 60s. He's a large, personable man of West Indian heritage. He favors patterned shirts that can be worn tail out. Something about his eyes. They're quite striking. Now, this may sound cliched, but he seems to look through you.
When I look at a person, things begin to come in, like something else take over, and they speak to me, and it makes sense. So it's not me doing it.
Well, if I was to use the New Age vernacular, it sounds like you're channeling information.
When I look at the house, I look at the sky, and I look at the trees, they vibrate. Maybe I'm in spiritual enlightenment. Someone call it spiritual enlightenment. We just had names for it. And I go back to the Bible, judge them from their work.
Well, his experiences suggest something more than a cold reading. A cold reading is simply the experience associated with human interactions by looking at people's faces. And people's faces certainly do reveal their thoughts, at least grossly, and certainly their feelings at the time, as any parent will tell you about a young child.
Dr. Michael Persinger is the director of the Neuroscience Research Group at Laurentian University.
However, there is more than cold reading to Mr. Haribance's capacity, and perhaps we can call it even talent. If Mr. Haribance doesn't even see the person, but only has a picture, his accuracy is remarkable with respect to the emotive and other details, suggesting that there's something captured even in a photograph, in that piece of space and time, for which he has some degree of access. And that may seem difficult to comprehend, but yet, when we are putting information on a piece of photographic emulsion, what we're seeing is what our perceptual systems has trained us to see. We really don't know what else is in those silver grains that can be extracted and interpreted by the appropriate brain structured in the appropriate manner.
I'm reminded of a first contact story told in anthropology circles about an African shaman who was shown a newspaper photograph of a large city at a distance, something the shaman had never seen before. All he saw was the pixels. The cityscape was transparent, as if invisible to the shaman's point of view.
I'm in touch with something, you know. That's why I'm telling people, the speakers, the knowledge is there. We just have names for things. You go back to the heart. I'm in touch. Call it God, call it what. I know I'm in touch with something, and they take over.
I think it's important to realize that the vast majority of stimuli that are in our environment around us every second, every day that we are alive, that amount of information is rarely processed by our brain. Basically, our brain is a giant insulator. Consciousness is a kind of insulator. So think of it this way. The electromagnetic spectrum that's out there is manifested across a wide range of frequencies, but we are only privy to a very narrow band, and that's only because we have eyes and heat sensors that we can transform that electromagnetism. The rest of these signals containing infinite amount of information, we do not have access to this information because we have no obvious sensors, because our brains cannot interpret it. But suppose your brain is constructed differently, like Sean Haribance. That means you potentially could discern stimuli that are around us all the time, but you can make sense out of it. Now, Once you've detected it, however, the labels that you give to it will be a function of your culture. So when Mr. Haribant says that he sees angels around you, or he knows information about you that the average person would not know, but only you know, that indicates that he's obtaining information from the environment around you or through you, but that he may be giving labels, the only labels he has, which reflect his religious tradition.
I can feel something out there. I think psychic things, parapsychology, the church, religion have a common foundation. And God is like the desert. We, like a grain of sand. If you really meditate and go under your heart, in the stomach area, I am not myself. I am somebody else.
You suggested that Sean Haribant's brain is different. How so?
Well, in order to discern unusual phenomena, to pick up what's in the environment that everyone could potentially detect, to do this, one has to have a different structured brain. That is, the material and the synapses within the brain are organized differently. Or, for a brief period of time, for many people, there are electrical changes that allow you to have that simulation for a brief amount of time, a brief insight into this experience. But for individuals like Haribant's, their brains must be structured permanently in a different manner than ours. What we found in our research is that this man does have a different structured brain, both neuropsychologically, electrically, and even in terms of chemically. He seems to be quite different.
It's as if Sean Haribant's experiences the world as an ongoing waking dream. And I asked Dr. Persinger about Sean's state of mind. Could he somehow be dreaming while awake?
Our data suggests that at least his right hemisphere may be engaged in what we would call an altered state, probably most of the time.
I know I'm in touch with big mind, higher consciousness, call it what you want. I'm in touch with something, I know.
So he may, for very long periods of time, perhaps hours a day, not all the time, but hours a day, his right hemisphere may be in the dream state, but he's not aware of it. It's only when he begins to engage in his readings, which clearly takes time for him to get into the state. He has to meditate, which is another way of saying intercalating or allowing the left and right hemisphere to be matched, only during these conditions that he then has access to it. So I would say, yes, he's probably in a dreamlike state, at least his right hemisphere is, for the majority of the day and certainly the night.
Sean Haribant's may be a visual listener. His central nervous system extracts information differently from the immediate environment, and his brain processes it differently. This may account for his childlike nature. He blurts out information, says whatever pops into his head, and sometimes it's embarrassing, crude. He's like the Howard Stern of the psychic world.
Now, why are good with sex life and motion and love life and health? Because your thoughts are energies.
There is some evidence that clairvoyance would describe things that today we might call auras, as something like an electromagnetic field that surrounds living systems generally, but not just living systems. All things, apparently, have some kind of field structure around it.
This is Dean Radin. He's the author of The Conscious Universe.
So if we were trying to think of how would we cast that in today's terms, we'd probably say that, yes, all living things have electromagnetic fields. Most structures of some type have fields around them. And depending on your favorite flavor of physical theory, everything can be described in terms of fields. So possibly in some altered states of consciousness, it is possible to directly perceive those fields.
The question of what is he actually seeing when he labels the phenomenon as an angel, that's an interesting question. And on the basis of what he says and how he perceives it, it may very well be that what he sees as an angel or describes as such may be a secondary or tertiary feature of the person themselves, in the sense we know there's tremendous energies emitted from the normal human body. If you look at the infrared outline of an individual, you can see this clearly. Your boundary actually goes out 3 to 4 times your typical body width. That he may be actually seeing some aspect of the person that he attributes to this type of entity.
The likelihood is that fields around living systems in particular are not, in a sense, generated. They're there all the time. And they change as dynamically as probably our thoughts change. Of course, in a trivial sense, we're just talking about things like brainwaves. Well, of course, they do radiate out. They're not very strong, but they're there. But we're probably talking about other fields as well. There's many different currents running in the body all the time that can create a variety of fields. Most of the time, we're in relatively ordinary states of awareness, and so the fields probably aren't all that unusual. But every so often, unusual things happen. People go into all unusual mental states, and it's very probable, I think, that the fields that surround us also change. So somebody who is sensitive to that can simply tell by looking at you what kind of where you are, not only physically, but probably mentally as well.
Michael Persinger's research, conducted at his unassuming laboratory at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario, is gaining currency in the scientific world. Using a machine, Dr. Persinger stimulates the human brain with subtle pulsed electromagnetic fields. That's EMF for short. 4 out of 5 subjects typically enter into a dreamlike world, a state of mind where they feel as if they're in communion with a power greater than themselves. They see things. Hear voices. Sean Harabance was stimulated with EMF.
The question is, can we imitate or facilitate his altered state by applying experimental fields? The answer is yes, we can. We found we could enhance it, and we could also interfere with it. But the point is, from our perspective, this is the first time this has been experimentally shown that you can actually change the accuracy and characteristic of these readings by applying known magnetic fields with characteristics that influence complex but known brain physiology.
My gift comes from when I watching that statue. That show up in my laboratory. When he was pulsing my energy, I saw Christ, Mother Mary, and apples very clear.
One of the reasons that religious icons enter into psi phenomena so frequently may have to do with the nature of the right hemisphere, again, because the right hemisphere is the mediator of psi experiences. It is also involved with space and deep meaning and emotion. It's also the source of the sense of presence, and the sense of presence is basically the feeling, and everyone has that capacity, of a sentient entity, a thinking entity that's beside you. The poets call it the muse, and very often it may have all kinds of positive or negative features, but because the right hemisphere is tied to the sense of presence, and the sense of presence is historically tied to religious experiences and religious visitations, that's probably one of the reasons that most cultures pair psi phenomena with the individual's religious beliefs. So it shouldn't surprise you that Mr. Harabance, being a Christian, would access Christ or Mary. Other individuals from other cultures may access Allah or some other religious icon, or even a specific guide, which is typical of some of the native cultures and some of the African and Eastern cultures. That's simply a mode by which they access that space. It's not unique or defining it. It's simply the mode by which they access it.
My feeling is that some 30,000 years ago, which is as far back as we can date shamanism.
Stan Krippner is a professor of psychology at the Saybrook Institute in San Francisco.
There were people who had biological propensities that made them capable of dream recall, storytelling, coupled with very keen observation of the environment. In other words, the shaman does go into imaginary worlds, but the shaman also fully lives in the consensual world, in the world of the here and the now. And when somebody with these sensitivities emerged in a tribe, the tribe knew how to protect that person, and that would be to the tribe's benefit. Now, 30,000 years later, somebody comes up with similar biological propensities, but they do not have a supportive community. So they see auras around people, they tell stories about their dreams, they have glimpses into the future, and their families say, well, I wouldn't mention that to anybody. People will think you are crazy. So eventually they just learn to shut up. Maybe as adults, they can find a group that supports them, and then they might become a medium or a sensitive. And some of them find an extremely supportive group, and like Sean Harabance of Trinidad, they become renowned in religious circles, even in scientific circles, as participants in research, and can make quite a contribution to their society. But I think that these are the exceptions. I really think that in the Western world today, most of the people with these sensitivities lose the sensitivity, repress the sensitivity, or actually are branded as mentally ill, and many of them actually are driven to mental illness because of the rejection. I think it's a pity, but I've seen this happen.
There's a tie that binds Sean Harabance to Mary Baker Eddy, Florence Nightingale, Eddie Ansley, St. Teresa, Joseph Smith of the Mormons, and Elizabeth G. White, founder of the Seventh-day Adventists. All of these people were called by a discarnate voice. They also suffered breakdowns of one sort or another, either in their physical or mental health. Breakdowns which altered their perception of events around them forever after.
Well, all behavior is generated by brain activity, and of course that's in large part discerned or determined by the subtle structure.
Michael Persinger.
If you've had a small or appropriate brain injury or a experience of hypoxia or perhaps some dietary peculiarity, just enough to produce these small changes, certain kinds of changes produce these unusual abilities, psi abilities, mystical experience. In fact, if you look historically at Christ or Muhammad, Buddha, almost any leader, even the more recent ones from the 19th century, you will see that they share many of the experiences of the contemporary limbic patient without the seizures. That doesn't necessarily mean what they have experienced is all unreal or hallucinatory. What we're saying is that there are certain kinds of small structures, structural changes within the brain that allow these individuals to have access to knowledge, or perhaps to synthesize knowledge that's novel, but at the same time extraordinarily profound.
Where do these voices, the visions, come from? I started out with an idea that science could help locate the headwaters of the divine. The source might be right hemispheric epilepsy. And modern-day forensic medicine suspects that some of the lives of the saints can be explained in this way. But they can't be explained away. This is the Venerable Jetsun Dampo Kalka Rinpoche. He's a Buddhist High Lama. Tibetan Buddhism acknowledges the existence of clairvoyance and telepathy. The Dalai Lama, for instance, consults with a state oracle. Now, if you saw the movie Kundun, you'll recall there's a scene where the oracle writhes and whispers, translates between the dimensions, reports what he hears in the spiritual realm to the assembled monks. In the movie, as in real life, the oracle has undergone rigorous training, so the supernatural voices are heeded by the Dalai Lama. Still, the information isn't totally reliable. There are errors of interpretation, errors of perception, because we're human. The next voice you hear is Jampa Shaneman, the Rinpoche's translator.
It is said in Buddhism that there are people with pure perception and people with impure perception. So it is possible for some people to navigate time, but if their perceptions are not pure, they would be interpreting the experiences they have due to the bias that they're from their delusion, whereas we would feel that an individual who has had what was called non-defiled abilities, that individual sees things exactly as they will, does not discriminate or taint them by their own predisposition or their particular traits of personality. That individual, for example, we would consider to be the fully enlightened Buddha, who directly perceives things without any adulteration to those phenomena and can completely navigate time, past, present, and future, with full knowingness. That is the enlightened being.
I've thought about the Rinpoche's teaching carefully. What I think he's telling me is that it's next to impossible to know the future. Why? Because anything that's truly new, a novel experience, would be transparent to the average person. For instance, and I've mentioned this before, what if I told you that an unidentified flying object had landed in the space where you are now? Let's say the room or the car. And it didn't quite square with what you think a UFO ought to be. Could you see it? Voices and visions. They exist. But seldom can we understand fully what they're telling us. And when we do, it's often too late. The Rinpoche offered a final suggestion. Acknowledge the voices, yes. The visions, too. But don't be distracted by them. Get on with living this life. Focus on the present time. He's right, I thought. A preoccupation with the future comes at the expense of the present. And besides, I already know the future. There's going to be an eternity to commune with the dead.
Tonight on Ideas, you've listened to part two of Visions and Voices by Dawn Hill. The program series was produced with the assistance of Linda Shorten. Technical assistance provided by Dave Field. You can purchase either a transcript or cassette copy of this two-part series. The transcripts cost $14 and the cassettes cost $26, taxes and shipping included. To order, call this number, area code 416-205-7367. That's 416-205-7367. Or you can send a check or money order to Ideas, CBC Radio 1, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Our email address is ideas@cbc.ca. The executive producer of Ideas is Richard Handler, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 for the hourly news, followed by the Arts Today and Between the Covers.